Keywords,
Volume 2, by Chan Master, Sheng Yan. Human Consciousness in the Chan Perspective. From Chan Newsletter, number 84, March, 1991. Brooklyn College, November 8, 1990. Buddhism speaks of human consciousness in terms of false mind or true mind. False mind is the state of ordinary sentient beings. It is the mind that suffers vexations arising from a self-centered view of the world. True mind is the mind free of vexations, a mind of wisdom. If false mind includes all levels of human consciousness and its activities, then what distinguishes true mind? The answer is that true mind arises when the mind is totally free from self-centeredness. At this point, it is no longer subject to the vexations of ordinary human consciousness. At this time, consciousness is no longer subjective, only perfect. Completely objective activity remains. It is important to understand that false mind is really what we call ordinary human consciousness. Consciousness itself has two aspects, discriminating consciousness and fundamental consciousness. Discriminating consciousness includes cognition, apprehension, and discrimination, commonly what we take to be memory, judgment, and reasoning. However, there is an aspect of consciousness which does not make discriminations. For the sake of discussion, we will call this fundamental consciousness. According to the Yogacara school, fundamental consciousness makes a person what he or she is. It is tempting to say that this fundamental consciousness is the core, essence, or true entity of someone, but these terms are misleading, since they make one think of substance, of something material, and this is not the understanding of Buddhism. These terms are sometimes used to define that which transmigrates from life to life when a being is reborn, but it is definitely nothing like the Christian understanding of the soul. We speak of consciousness in human beings, but do we recognize such a faculty in animals? In Western thought, this question is usually answered in terms of the species in question. Most Western science recognizes consciousness in so-called higher animals, such as elephants, monkeys, or cats, but it does not recognize consciousness in lower animals, such as earthworms or insects. In the Buddhist view, lower life forms may lack discriminating consciousness, but they still have fundamental consciousness. In other words, all living beings have consciousness. For this reason, Buddhist compassion is directed to all living beings, human or otherwise, that all can evolve to Buddhahood. The goal of Buddhist practice is to free living beings from the vexations that arise out of the habit of making discriminations. To attain true mind, we must also be freed from fundamental consciousness, because our karma is centered there. In other words, the seeds of our previous actions and the forces that they exert upon us are stored there. This is the reason why fundamental consciousness is sometimes called the storehouse consciousness. Put another way, to attain the true mind of wisdom, sentient beings must liberate themselves from discriminating consciousness, and they must diffuse the karmic force of fundamental consciousness. This is the ultimate direction of Buddhist practice. But how can we truly tell when we have overcome vexation and reached wisdom? Vexation and wisdom are both mental activities, but the crucial difference is that vexation is centered on the self. It is this centering on the self that causes suffering. However, with wisdom, one sees things as they are, unconcerned with the self, untainted by personal subjectivity. The Chan point of view. How does Chan differ from this Buddhist view of consciousness that I have just described? The answer is that Chan is a tradition within Buddhism, and its understanding and perspective fall entirely within the basic tenets of Buddhism. However, In Chan, we often speak of Buddha mind, another name for true mind. In other words, Buddha mind is the mind of wisdom. Chan also speaks of the mind of sentient beings as the false mind of vexation. One important phrase used in Chan can be translated as, to illuminate the mind and perceive Buddha nature. Why does the mind need illumination? It is because the mind of sentient beings is clouded in darkness, and this darkness must be lifted to see the true nature of reality. Thus, to illuminate the mind and perceive Buddha nature means leaving behind the mind of vexation in order to attain wisdom. So the goal of Chan practice is identical to the goal of Buddhism. Chan practice, then, revolves around this idea of attaining true mind, which is to say, Buddha mind. For the beginner, the foundation is to start with a mind of vexation, false mind, and the goal is the Buddha's wisdom, or true mind. By now, we can see that the Western understanding of consciousness does not cover all of the meanings of consciousness in Buddhism. In Western science, mental activities are researched, analyzed, and recorded, but is true mind, the mind of wisdom, a mental activity that can be scrutinized? If we attempt to use the concept of consciousness to explain true mind, there will be quite a bit of confusion. It might be possible to say that true mind represents a kind of pure, undefiled mental activity, while false mind represents impure mental activity, but this would still lack clarity. To avoid confusion, Chan masters simply refer to mind. Thus, when speaking of Chan practice, we can see that Buddha mind and the mind of sentient beings are not fundamentally different. We can look at false mind as the process of practice, and true mind as the goal of practice. When you first start to practice, it is likely that you will notice that your mind is not at ease, not calm and peaceful. To change that, you can use shamatha, a method of meditation for calming or stilling the mind. The goal is to bring the mind to a standstill. This process can also be thought of as clarifying and settling the mind. One can use the analogy of a glass of muddy water that becomes clear once the water is still and the dirt sinks to the bottom. The Chan approach to the problems that arise from human consciousness. The Chan approach to resolving one's problems is quite different from the psychological approach where the person's problems are the centerpiece of analysis. In psychotherapy, one's problems are analyzed. Themes and motives are suggested, and the patient is urged to recognize patterns from early childhood and to break the hold they have upon him. The approach of Chan is different. Practitioners learn to simply put down their vexations and leave them behind. This does not mean that you should ignore what you have to do in life. It simply means that you abandon the idea that what confronts you constitutes a problem. You continue to deal with situations, but you no longer see them as problems. In this way, the problems cease to exist. How do you go about putting aside your problems? One solution is to develop compassion for other beings. When you see the vexation and suffering that torments others, you can try to help them resolve their problems and end their suffering. In this process, it will be easier to put your own problems aside for the sake of others. This is compassion. Where does this compassion come from? It comes from Bodhi mind, the mind of realizing Chan. The flyer that announced this lecture contained two Chinese characters, which can be translated as beginner's mind. What does this mean? This is the mind of an ordinary sentient being that has taken the first steps in turning his or her mind towards illumination. This step is sometimes called the first arising of Bodhi mind. But what is Bodhi? In Sanskrit, Bodhi means awakening or enlightenment. To develop Bodhi mind, you begin to engage in activities that are not centered on yourself, dealing with all problems in an objective way. Ironically, this can be the way that you will resolve your own problems. With this attitude, you clear away the mind of vexation and attain the mind of wisdom. Last week, I traveled to the West Coast, where I gave a talk to an audience including psychiatrists and neuroscientists. At the end of the talk, someone asked, "You say that your methods are simpler than ours. How can that be?" I replied, "In psychotherapy, you have to find out a great deal, the patient's personal history. You must ask a great many questions. The patient often must come back again and again, and this process can last for years. When I address someone's problems, I don't spend too much time finding out about their background. I speak a few sentences, and that will begin to provide them with help." I added that among my students, or my patients, if you prefer, are psychologists and psychiatrists. Some come to me because they developed problems after listening to so many of their patients' problems. Others come to learn the way of Chan so that they can help themselves or their patients. At first, it may not be very easy to use Chan methods with psychotherapy. The basic concepts are quite different. In general, psychotherapy is more analytical, while Chan is more direct. It is also important to add that unless the Chan master is very expert, it will be difficult for him or her to effectively help people. By contrast, some types of therapy can be learned in a reasonable amount of time so that a therapist can provide his or her patients with some relief. But in the beginning, it is not easy to combine the two approaches. Let us now look at the ways Chan can help people deal with psychological problems. Chan recognizes that suffering, vexation, and confusion are mostly created within the mind rather than from the external world. This inner mind is the state of consciousness that Chan methods address. As such, methods of cultivation fall under two general classifications. The first is called contemplating mind. The second, transcending thoughts. Each method serves a special purpose. Which one is better depends on the person, although it may happen that one person can employ methods in both categories. The procedure in contemplating mind is to keep your attention on the present moment and focus on some external object, a feeling or part of the body, or simply a thought or an idea. If you are concentrating on a thought, since concentrating is itself a thought, this can be described as using a later thought to observe an earlier one. This method helps to overcome the mind's disorganization, the usual state where thoughts come and go in a disorderly, random manner. This method will help you stabilize your mind. Gradually, thoughts become simpler and less disorganized. There are many methods of contemplating the mind. For example, you can concentrate on the rise and fall of your lower abdomen while you breathe, or you can concentrate on your breathing. Or, as mentioned earlier, you can watch your thoughts as they arise and disappear. You can also try to keep your mind free of thoughts. If any thoughts arise, you ignore them and bring your mind back to the thought-free state. These methods may seem simple, but they are not that easy to do and take a lot of practice. We have an 8-hour class at our center just to teach the very simple method of counting the breath. This is because there are many subtle aspects to this method and many principles behind it. Improperly understood and executed, the method will leave your mind running wild no matter how hard you try to contain it. The second category, transcending thoughts, consists of having the attitude of non-attachment to yourself or others. The goal is roughly described by the Chan phrase, the mind free from thoughts and free from discrimination. To be free from all this is to be enlightened. Whichever Chan method you use, please refrain from relying on words or speech. Words represent ideas, concepts, and images, and only by leaving these things behind can you begin to understand true mind. Two Chan maxims convey this idea. The first says, whatever you think is off the mark. In other words, whatever you are thinking is erroneous, no matter how clear or accurate you believe it to be. The second maxim is, whatever you say is off the mark. No matter how well chosen or clearly spoken, words rely on thoughts and ideas, and are thus fundamentally wrong. Nonetheless, you will notice that Chan masters talk a lot. They also sometimes write a lot. But the point of what we talk or write about is to convey that whatever you think or say is erroneous. That is the content of all of my talks. No words or description will suffice to describe a state of realization. Therefore, talking about realization is not Chan. Anyone trying to describe such a state would be considered by a Chan master to be a clever devil, not an awakened being. Therefore, many Chan masters use no words when interacting with disciples. Instead, they use movements or gestures, even shouts. Or sometimes, when they do use words, it is in an unconventional way. If a student asks a question about A, the master may give an answer that refers to B, something totally unrelated. These methods are designed to help students to drop the habit of reasoning themselves to true mind. Reasoning will not free you from mind, thought, or consciousness. A story from the Tang Dynasty tells of a disciple who asked his master, "How can I calm my mind?" The master said, "I'm too busy right now. Why not consult your first Dharma brother?" The disciple did as he was told. The first Dharma brother said, "I have a headache. I can't talk now. Why not talk to second Dharma brother?" But the second Dharma brother said, "I have a stomachache. Why don't you talk to master?" So the disciple went back to his master and complained, "Nobody told me how to calm my mind. Nobody told me anything." The master said, "You really are a stupid fool. Everybody has been telling you how to calm your mind." Upon hearing this, the disciple realized enlightenment. Does this make sense to you?